Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause and keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. So it's good to see so many people here tonight. We had an impromptu celebration of our two-year anniversary in this building, which would have been actually in October when we moved in. It seems to be our MO to do things about a month late here. So I've just been kind of reflecting on community. I've been reflecting on, you know, some of the more interconnected teachings of the Buddha, the importance of what's called Sangha, the importance of having a sense of community to practice with. One thing that I noticed early on in my meditation practice is it always felt a little bit easier to meditate around other people in some ways. In some ways, it was also scary because trusting myself to close my eyes with a bunch of strangers was weird. But once I got used to that part, something about feeling supported. You know, we all drove all the way out here tonight to come to this group. You know, because each one of us, you know, sees some potential benefit in this practice, whether we're new to it or not. And so there's something connecting about that. I don't think that any spiritual path can really be developed without a sense of community. And so tonight I wanted to talk about the Buddhist teachings on loving kindness. And I want to talk about the topic of for the love and liberation of all beings. For the love and liberation of all beings. You know, why do we practice mindfulness? In the Western culture, maybe to get more focused and more present and less reactive and more intentional. You know, but I think at the end of the day, we want to feel fulfilled in our lives. You know, we want to feel connected. Those are the things that create a life worth living, for lack of better terms, maybe. So I've just been thinking lately, we had a teacher in town, Mary Stankavage, one of my first teachers, and she talked about, she gave a Dharma talk on the topic of an undefended heart, living with an undefended heart. And I really like that. It speaks to me quite a bit because I feel like if there is a goal for myself in this practice, it's to try to live with less of a defended heart, more openness, more open-heartedness. You know, now if you would have told that to my teenage self, I would have called you a hippie and wanted nothing to do with that. I didn't trust that. I didn't even know what that meant. You know, but I think that really, well, the Buddha describes this path of practice, the middle path, the Eightfold Path, as like an excavation of an ancient city. You know, he says that we're all just trying to live in and re-inhabit the space in our heart. That's oftentimes covered up by the judgments and the comparisons and the criticisms and the doubts and the, you know, what we call the hindrances traditionally. These coverings of our heart. And so the process of awakening or healing or whatever you want to call it, you know, of recovery. I know there are a lot of people in recovery here. I think to some degree it's like an excavation. Like you go to this old archaeological site and you have to dig up through all the dirt and all the shit to find what's underneath. You know, all the beliefs and all the things that we picked up over our lifetime that, you know, we've collected from our environments. And so I want to read a quote by Emily McDowell. She says, "Finding yourself is not really how it works. You aren't a $10 bill in last winter's coat pocket. You're also not lost. You're right here, buried under cultural conditioning, other people's opinions, and inaccurate conclusions you drew as a kid that became your beliefs about who you are. Finding yourself is actually returning to yourself, an unlearning, an excavation, a remembering who you were before the world got its hands on you. And so many of you know I had a baby recently. And the thing that's so beautiful about little kids is that there's no social shame. You know, there's no rules that they follow. They'll fart in front of anyone. They'll throw up on anyone. They'll cry in anyone's hands. They'll laugh and smile at just about anyone too. You know? And so I like where what she says here, remembering who you were before the world got its hands on you. There's a teacher named Chogyam Trungpa that Mikey quoted in our workshop yesterday. I really love this. He said that, you know, Buddhism is trying to be a child again without being childish. You know, how can we be a child without being childish? Taking full responsibility for ourselves and our actions, but learning to be more embodied, more in the heart, you know, more present, for lack of better words, right? That's what I love about Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings, is it's just so simple. He just talks about the importance of being present. He says the present's the most important moment because it's completely made up of your past and is completely creating your future. And so in some ways, living with an undefended heart is about embodying the present moment. You know, but we have to remember the present moment because we forget it all the time. And many of y'all know that the translation of the word mindfulness originally comes from the term satipatthana, which means to remember the ground. It means to kind of remember that you're here, buried underneath all of this cultural conditioning of other people's opinions and inaccurate conclusions you drew as a kid and your beliefs about who you are. Right? Deep down, we all want safety. We want happiness. We want to live with peace. Now, the ways we go about trying to find that, right, our shortcomings, if you will, are really just coping strategies in disguise. All the ways that we've tried to learn to find peace and ease through drugs and alcohol, or through recognition or praise, or through perfectionism or workaholism or whatever it may be. These are all just, they're really are not so much shortcomings as impersonal failings, but they're just our coping strategies that we've developed over a lifetime. There are answers to life's difficulty. And guess what the Buddha said? First noble truth, life is difficult. Have you noticed that? And it feels normalizing to me. It's like finally I found a spiritual practice. I don't think that any religion is goes unflawed, because we're all humans practicing religions. But I finally found a spiritual tradition that I didn't feel was lying to me. When I sat down for the first time and meditated, and all of my anxiety, all of my fear, all of this discomfort arose in my body and my mind, and then I heard the Dharma talk that, have you noticed that life is difficult? That there's suffering and dissatisfaction and dis-ease in life? And I was like, fucking totally. I've noticed that. Have you noticed that it's made difficult by our incessant need for things to be other than the way that they actually are? That was the part that I was like, oh shit, wait a second. Right? Rewind the tape. That's part of my problem, is this inability to really cope with life on life's terms, right? To be with things as they are in actuality. And that means that to some degree we have to be able to embody all of the worldly winds of life, pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and recognition and disgrace and, right? The joys and the sorrows. That's what the Chinese Buddhists say. Life is 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. So how do we live in that? The mind wants the joy. It wants the success. It wants the recognition. It wants the praise. Sometimes we get that. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's this relentless chasing to try to find. You ever notice your mind's telling you that you're finally going to be able to arrive in the next thing once you get the next thing? It's the trick of the mind. It's this craving and this clinging and this aversion to the discomfort or dis-ease. But how can we learn to bring an embodied compassion? And so what does embodiment mean? It's kind of a lot of meditation teachers, I think, made that shit up. It means being present with discomfort and dis-ease. Number one thing I hear from people that dedicate themselves to a meditation practice, this is hard. I was joking with someone before the group tonight. First time we ever meditated together, she said, "This is hard." And whenever I hear that, I feel like, yeah, you're on the right track. Sure, there's some degree of once we relax and settle, there's maybe some peace that we feel and experience pretty early on too, right? But it puts us in touch with whatever is here. No matter what's here. A restless mind, we don't get to get rid of the restless mind just because we decide we want to meditate. But we get to be with it. We get to meet it and open to it in an open-hearted way. And we get to say, "I see you, mind. May you be at ease." Not may you be easy. Not may you be different. Not can I meditate you away or change you or fix you, but can I be at ease? Can I be gentle with this experience that I'm in? Underneath all of our shortcomings, all of our defenses, if you will, is what in Tibetan Buddhism they refer to as Buddha nature. Now, you're already awake. You're already, I've heard it the best on a t-shirt that one of my first Dharma teachers used to wear. And his t-shirt just said, "Nothing's wrong with you. Nothing's wrong with you. Absolutely nothing." It's again, it's what the mind does to try to create this sense of self that's better than or less than. You know, that needs to be better looking or smarter or more competitive or whatever it is. But it's our Buddha nature. It's our natural state. Do you notice that when you're in pain, it hurts? It's because you care. It's because you have a brain that has wired into it empathy. Some people believe that there are some true antisocial sociopaths out there in the world that maybe don't experience that. I don't know if that's true. I think maybe their generational trauma and it's maybe really deep down there. They have a lot of digging to do, but I think it's in all of us that we care when we're in pain. And so we just built these defenses, and I like the word fortification. You know, like when you're a kid and you build a fort. When you fortify something, you protect it. You know, I think about like all the ways that the habits and the kind of familiar, comfortable places that I get in my life that are causing me pain and suffering. A lot of those are just defenses from feeling pain or loneliness or boredom or whatever it may be, right? Fortification means the action of building a defensive wall or other reinforcement to strengthen a place against attack. So a lot of what defends us underneath, a lot of the times, is fear. You know, like we're under attack. And then when I started picking up some of these habits, I'm like, wait a second. At that time in my life, I felt like I was under attack. So of course I started, you know, using drugs and alcohol when I was 14. 13. You know, of course I started to isolate. Of course I learned to use sarcasm to deflect. Of course I learned to, cut other people down and be harsh and quick-witted. Of course I learned all those things because those were my fortification. But the problem, and Mary Stankavage talked about this too, is when we build up a defense, we have to sit in and with the pain that's being protected. We trap ourselves in with it. So when we start to practice mindfulness, we have to be gentle towards whatever comes up. You know, whatever we experience, it's not just about being aware, but it's about being aware, as Jon Kabat-Zinn says, in a particular way. Right? Because harsh awareness is not mindfulness. There's this thing in the Eightfold Path, it's called Sammasati. Samma, sometimes it's translated as right, like right, and then sati is mindfulness. But really what it means is it means harmonious, complete, holistic. So what's a complete or a holistic or a harmonious or a balanced way to practice mindfulness? Not just being aware, but being aware in a particular way, with kindness. We can't fall victim to the tyranny of the mind, the criticism, the harshness. Have you noticed that your mind is a monster sometimes? You know, the way that we talk to ourselves in here, the tone of the voice. So we start to bring awareness to the mind itself. And to try to take, as crazy as this sounds, to try to take your mind less personally. That's a part of the insight of practicing mindfulness. Your mind is like one of your senses. It thinks. That's its job. It's going to think until the day you die. You don't get up in the morning and say, all right, I'm going to start thinking now. Right? And then you go to bed at the end of the night, you're like, all right, I'm going to stop right now. You don't have any fucking control over that thing. I always like to say it's like an annoying roommate you're stuck with the rest of your life. So what do you do with an annoying roommate? You have to learn to cooperate. You don't have to love your mind. You don't have to spend every moment with it. Right, but we have to learn how to have a healthy relationship to the mind. This is what metta is all about. I want to read a quote by Pema Chodron. She says, "It is only when we begin to relax with ourselves that meditation becomes a transformative process. Only when we relate with ourselves without moralizing, without harshness, without deception, can we let go of harmful patterns. Without metta or loving kindness, letting go of old habits can become abusive." And this is an important point, she says. So what is metta? Traditionally, metta comes from this word, mitta, which means, actually it means friend. So being friendly to the mind. And I like this because sometimes it's translated as loving kindness, and I think in our Western world, the word love has a lot of baggage with it. You know, it's like, what is it? This like romantic love that I'm supposed to just love myself. You know, it's more something like, can I be unconditionally kind and gentle? As an aspiration, the answer is usually no. I don't feel kind and gentle, but can I practice being present in a particular way? Telling my mind, I see you. May you be at ease. Sometimes kindly setting a limit with the mind. I see you, not right now. We're not going to go there right now. Thanks. I appreciate your opinion. I know you care about me, but we're not going to do that. So we have to learn how to navigate the mind, but in a gentle way, with unconditional friendliness. Or, if dare we say, loving kindness, right? I want to talk a little bit about love. And I shared this quote a couple weeks ago, but it's just so great I wanted to share it again. It's by Martin Luther King Jr. He talks about love. He used to talk a lot about love because as a nonviolent activist, this was the choice of activism. This was the mission of that form of activism, is nonviolence and love. So this is what he says. "And I say to you, I've decided to stick with love, for I know that love is ultimately the answer to humankind's problems. And I'm going to talk about it everywhere I go. I know it's not popular to talk about in some circles today. And I'm not talking about emotional bosh when I talk about love. I'm talking about a strong, demanding love. For I've seen too much hate. And I say to myself that hate is too great of a burden to bear. I've decided to love. And if you're seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. When I think about my friends in my life, my true friends, I think about this strong, demanding love. It's not, as he's saying here, it's not this emotional bosh, as he says. Right? It's not this like gooey, romantic, like blockbuster movie love. It's like, I got your back. I'm here for you through thick and thin. I'm gonna show up when you don't think I'm gonna show up. And I think that he hits the nail on the head in terms of practicing loving kindness, that it needs to be strong and demanding. Practicing love takes effort. You know, sometimes we think that it's this kind of passive emotion that just somehow comes spontaneously out of the heart. And sometimes it does. I think it's natural, it's innate in experiences to feel it that way. But sometimes we have to really lift our mind, to incline our mind in that direction. The Buddha says to gladden the mind, and that it takes some effort to practice. Whatever you practice, you get better at. Whatever you practice, you get better at. We can practice friendliness, kindness to ourselves. The mind, it learns things. That's one of the great things about the mind. And it can unlearn things. And so this is the mental training of mindfulness. When you're practicing and sitting in meditation, you notice your mind wandering, you can actually make the decision to return your attention back to the breath, to let that thought, just for 1 second, we can let that thought go. Now, maybe it's a half a second early on, right? But as you practice, you can see that you can train the mind, not to control, but to have this awareness of the thought stream that arises and passes. So the root of metta is friendliness. I remember hearing, I believe it was Joseph Goldstein, who's a Buddhist teacher in the West, he lives in Massachusetts, talk about one of his teachers early on. He was on retreat and he went to his teacher to kind of report all of his insights. He was really able to see his mind clearly and to not identify with it and see the arising and passing of it, these like really deep, you know, insights. And his teacher looked at him and he said, "Have you made your mind a friendly companion yet? Have you made your mind a friendly companion yet?" As if that's the real goal of the practice. Not to necessarily recognize, you know, some powerful insight that's just going to all of a sudden alter reality and we're going to be birthed into this like huge liberating moment and never take birth again, you know? Maybe. But I think really if I'm trying to do something, I'm trying to make my mind a friendly companion. So I want to read the Metta Sutta and talk a little bit about inclining this outward towards all beings, and then we'll do a little bit of practice together. So sometimes when I read the sutta, I like to encourage people to just sit and, you know, let whatever resonates resonate and let whatever doesn't, let that go. Sometimes we can listen into ourselves when we're listening to some of these teachings. So this is the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness. It's called the Metta Sutta. He delivered it probably about 2,600 years ago. This is what he said. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened by duties and frugal in their ways. Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they're weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths. Outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. The Buddha really sets a high bar with loving kindness. I love the inclusivity of this teaching to all beings. He says, whether they're weak or strong, short, mighty, medium, seen and unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, all beings. He said, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. You ever find yourself despising beings in certain states that they're in? So the focus here is on this, the reality that we're all connected. You know, that we have to separate actors from their actions. And that means this goes both ways. We have to understand that some actions are unacceptable. You know, some of the harm that people in these states create are unforgivable actions. They're not okay. And we have to also see that suffering is caused through confusion and ignorance. And someone living in a state where they cause such harm is suffering, ultimately. It doesn't mean we have to, they say sometimes you can invite someone into your heart without inviting them into your home. It doesn't mean that we have to stick around and try to support someone that's causing us a tremendous amount of harm. But the aspiration here is to wish for all beings to be free from suffering. Thich Nhat Hanh calls this interbeing, the immense interconnectivity of all beings. You know, we don't wake up alone. Human beings are mirrors of each other's potential and each other's shortcomings. You know, I don't know if you've noticed, but when you get around your family in the holidays, all of a sudden shit becomes hard again. It's like, oh man, I thought I got over this. It's like, no, I just wasn't around my family for a year. You know what I mean? Other people help challenge us in areas and ways that otherwise we wouldn't do the work on. They kind of lay dormant in us until we get around other people sometimes. You know, but then to enter into community or to enter into relationship with other beings means that we're kind of put up against this social anxiety of entering into a tribe. You know, trying to figure out what our place is. Do we fit in here? This is the Buddhist meditation center. These people look Buddhist. Do I look like the Buddhist? Do I fit in with the Buddhist? That all that social separateness comes up. One of the ways I've heard the First Noble Truth defined before, the word dukkha, sometimes it's defined as dis-ease or disjointedness or distress. That inherent in life, there's dis-ease and distress. But it actually, sometimes it comes etymologically from this word du-akash, which means separate from the other. So sometimes when we engage in social situations, we actually engage with our feeling of separateness. And there's a guy named Mario Martinez that kind of studies these relational wounds that we experience of shame, betrayal, abandonment. A lot of the harm that has been caused in my life has come through relationships. So we take a risk in trying to practice loving kindness to all beings and to connect in spiritual communities or just to connect with people in general. It's vulnerable to do that. There's a guy named Charles Eisenstein that says, the state of inner being is a vulnerable state. It is the vulnerability of the naive altruist, of the trusting lover, of the unguarded sharer. To enter it, one must leave behind the seeming shelter of a control-based life, protected by a wall of cynicism, judgment, and blame. You ever notice that part in the mind that says, I'm different, they're different? The cynic, the skeptic, the judger, the one that's blaming? That's our defense. There it is, and that thing's strong. And so one of the ways that we can easily start to feel into this inner being, this connectedness with all beings, is through service, through generosity. This is said to be the first thing that Buddha would teach people to do when they came to him and said, I want what you have. I want what you have. They'd go to the Buddha and he'd say, all right, do service. Start there. Because I think what we can get into, like a community like this, you're coming out for the first time tonight, you sit down, you know, when we're just trying to participate in a community, all of that separateness can come up and keep us from connecting. But when you help someone, you can't help but connect to something very human that lies in all of us. That desire that we talked about in the beginning, that we all want to be happy. And some people who are less fortunate or down and out or just need our help, we're able to help them and we see that that's good. We feel it. We don't intellectually know it, we feel it. George Bernard Shaw says, I'm of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it's my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die. For the harder I work, the more I live. So this is the aspiration, right? This is the high bar. The good thing I love about mindfulness is it's such a practice of humility, is we work with whatever comes up. We work with whatever comes up and we practice and we just stay curious. If you want to know what develops insight, what is the transformative power of mindfulness, it's investigation, it's curiosity. It's a willingness to ask ourselves the question, what is this right now? How am I feeling right now? What's going on right now? How do I want to respond to what I'm experiencing right now? To have that inner space that opens up where we can choose our response. Every moment, there's an opportunity to practice something. This is empowering. Every moment, there's an opportunity to practice something. And we don't need to get bogged down in this shame of, when we make the mistake or when we fuck up, we can say, no, there's now a new moment. There's always a new moment to practice something. If we get too caught up in the last moment, we don't take advantage of this moment. You know what I mean? So practicing metta, we can also do this as a meditation practice. We start with ourselves. And we bring into our meditation practice this deep desire somewhere in here to be at peace, to be safe, to be protected from harm. That deep down we want freedom, whatever that may mean or be for us. And we try to bring that intention into the mind. The Buddha says we should sustain this recollection. I like the word recollection, means to recollect. So during the meditation, your mind is still going to wander. You're going to get bored. Whatever is going to come up is going to come up. Don't think of the meditation practice as this tendency we all have to get caught in the outcome. Like, I need to feel love. You know what I mean? But it's rather, can I practice really connecting and putting intention behind my deepest desire for freedom and well-being? And when my mind wanders, I'm going to be kind to my mind. I'm going to notice it in a different way. I'm going to say, hey, man, totally cool. I love you, mind. May you be at ease. Your mind works really hard for you. It deserves a little bit of love. You know what I mean? But it's like a little kid. It's just like you don't want it to drive the car all the time. So during the meditation, being kind to whatever comes up and letting go of expectations. Watching the cynic says, shit, I just spent my Sunday night. I could have been doing about 5 other things right now. Listening to love and kindness. Right? The bore, the cynic, the judger, that whatever comes up, we get to see it. And we get to say, ah, I see you. So we start with ourselves, but then we're going to do this practice where we break into these different categories. And this is taught in the commentaries on this sutta of how to practice and how to develop a mind of loving kindness is to use these different categories. So you start with yourself, and then you think of your loved ones. Or sometimes I just pick one person. They call this a benefactor. I like to say if this person was to walk in the room right now, you would feel happy to see them. It can be a dog. I remember when I first started this practice, I was like, I got no one. I'm sorry. And then the teacher said, it can be a dog. I was like, okay, sweet. It can be a cat. I'm not a cat person, but I get it. Might do that for you. It can be a niece or a nephew. It can be a little kid you saw at the park. It doesn't matter what it is. It's just something that helps you to connect to that feeling of being around someone and just being feeling a little bit lighter, accepted. Then we move into the category of the neutral person. So everyone right now, just think of someone that you've seen or that you know that you maybe don't have a lot of a relationship with. Maybe it's a coworker, but they work in a different department. You just see them there. Or maybe you go to the same gas station every day and there's a clerk or someone that checks you out. For the longest time, mine was the person at the YMCA that scanned my card. And I would practice. Every other day I did metta, and I still do. But early on in my practice, for probably 90 days, 6 months, I was doing loving kindness for these different categories. I'd go into the gym and I'd be cheesing at this person like... I'd be like, I'm kind of creeping myself out right now. I've shot. But because I really sat down intentionally, I thought of this person. And that deep down they want peace and ease and happiness in their life, whatever that looks like for them. And I spent time with them in my mind. You know, and actually over time I started to feel it a little bit. And it took time. The neutral person, then there's the difficult person. We already know this person, probably 5 or 6 of them. Someone that in your life is challenging. Now, here's what I'm going to encourage you. I'm going to not encourage you to pick up the 100-pound weight right away. You know what I mean? You'll be sore as hell tomorrow. You try to lift that. So, you know, some of us have, for real, have trauma, have real deep wounds around some people in our life. And so you don't want to just go into that practicing loving kindness. So maybe someone that's just kind of annoying or just hard to be around or difficult, strong-willed, difficult personality. You know any of these people? And so I wonder what their experience is like. I wonder what deep down, I wonder if they want peace and happiness in their life. And although we have to have the wisdom to know that they're still responsible for their actions, and we're not just writing them a free pass on whatever harm they may have caused, we're not doing a forgiveness practice right now either. We're just trying to say, no matter the confusion and suffering in your life, I wish that eventually you find ease and peace and happiness. And then the last category is all beings, all living beings. So we'll spend a couple minutes just kind of practicing. I like to use phrases to just repeat silently to myself. I like simple phrases. I overcomplicate shit. So with my meditation practice, I need something real simple. So I like to use these three phrases. For myself, may I be at ease, may I be at peace, may I be kind and gentle with myself. May I be at ease, may I be at peace, may I be kind and gentle with myself. You can use whatever phrases you want, but try to pick maybe three, four. You don't have to use a lot. And just try to keep coming back to the phrase. Here's the most important part. See if you can really put intention behind each phrase as you say it. I like to say it's like if you're eating the last meal of your life, how much you would try to savor each bite. When you say each phrase, try to really feel and connect with that intention. It doesn't mean you're going to feel this expansive love. Maybe you will. But the importance is that you're trying to really show up for it. You know what I mean? Really show up for that phrase when you say it. So we'll do it for ourselves. May I be at ease. May I be at peace. May I be kind and gentle with myself. Then we'll do it for the benefactor, the neutral person, the difficult person, and all beings. Sound good? All right.